The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Welcome back to Millennial. I'm now here with Pox Populi. So Pox, I think this is your third time on Millennial. We first encountered each other, I think it was in 2018, and then there was a break, and now here you are again for the third time. Would you like to introduce yourself to people who might not know of you?
Sure, and thanks for having me on Millennial again. Later we're going to talk about creativity and metapolitics and things like that, and this is one of the greatest examples of creativity that we have going on our side of things. And I know you said last year's Millennial kind of left you with a little bit of a sad feeling. It wasn't a very good year, but I think this year has been fantastic. The first time guests this year have been amazing, brilliant. So I'm really happy to be here, yeah, for my third time. This is the second time in a row, but you're right. There was I think it was like a 3 or 4 year, period where I wasn't doing much and I didn't appear. To introduce myself, it's a story I've told many times, but I was born in the United States. My father is Italian, and my mother's side are Irish and Welsh immigrants from earlier days. So I grew up in America, then I moved back to Europe. I have lived in a few European countries. I did that because I felt called to go back to the motherland, as it were. And I also wanted to see some things with my own eyes. This was several years ago now, but things were already happening. And I wanted to see what was really going on. And it was part of my red pilling process, I guess. Then in 2018, the year we had our first Millennial conversation, that's the year I started making YouTube videos, very much modeled after what you were doing, which was basically talking to a camera about how life is like in this day and age. And I was talking to the camera about things that were important to me, such as Italy and Ireland and France, and in particular, those years ago, you know, in 2018, very recently had occurred the Bataclan terrorist attacks, along with some other atrocities in France. That really affected me because I used to live in France and I had made many French friends. I said in, I think, my introductory video that for me was kind of like my 9/11, even though I grew up during 9/11 in America. How old would I have been in 2001? I was 12, I guess, or 11. So I mean, still young to fully appreciate the full meaning and effect that event had on life and on the United States. But with the attacks in Bataclan, you know, in Paris, I was much older and the effect they had on me was a lot different. a lot deeper. And so that inspired me as well to just talk about these things and get some things off my chest. And also rather quickly, I found myself making videos as if I were speaking to conservatives, actually. I didn't make any videos like, let's see what the crazy, you know, loony left is up to and the SJWs and all that, because everyone was doing that and they were doing it very well. And I wasn't going to be able to add much or add anything different. So a lot of the things I was saying sort of organically ended up being about how to get conservatives off the fence and to courageously take their own side and to stop being basically like just, you know, liberals going the speed limit, I guess, you know. And then that's what led me here today, eventually.
All right. I'm just trying to sort out the Odyssey live stream. I think I might have messed up just before I started this. So my apologies to anyone who's waiting for that. It will show up in the next few minutes. I can't remember if we talked about this before in one of the previous appearances, but let's go over it now because, you know, hindsight is always interesting. You said, I mean, there are numerous things, but 9/11, my perception is, and I was obviously in Britain at the time, I didn't see the American response to it, but after a while, it was almost as if the event was so huge that we just couldn't respond to it. There was no way to digest it. And so after a few years, it sort of fell away when it should have defined that decade and the next decade. In theory, it was so huge and so monumental that it should have been, it should still be a thing now in daily life, really. And yet it feels like just like a fashion fad from 20 years ago. And it is a long time ago now. But even so, just within a few years, it was as if we just couldn't deal with it because it was so threatening. It was such a change to the idea of the hegemon of America. What would you say about that?
Well, like I said, at the time, I would have been far too young to see it that way. What I remember is that immediately after 9/11, everyone put American flags in their front yard or, you know, waving from the front porch. There were some people in my, you know, social circle around the same age who kind of repeated their parents, I think, and said, "Oh, I knew this was an attack. I knew we were under attack the moment it happened." And I remember thinking, "No, you didn't. When the first plane hit, we had no idea." I remember, I think we heard about it on the radio driving to school. And then I was in sort of the common area of my school. And nobody had any idea what was going on. And the adults just told us, you know, focus on getting to class and, you know, put your nose in the book, basically. And then very quickly after, the Bush administration started the war on terror. But in the wrong country, apparently. But again, from my perspective as a preteen, I thought it was the defining moment. I thought, you know, this is like the history books. I'm going to live history and we're going to be the good guys. We're going to go to war. We're going to get the bad guys. And I'm going to live in the shadow of heroes. You know, I fully expected to idolize Donald Rumsfeld, you know, as like a war hero, a great statesman, Colin Powell, all these men of the Bush administration. And I remember watching, what was it called? Operation Iraqi Freedom and the shock and awe. I remember watching that on television. And I remember my mother phoned my grandfather. And I remember they were speaking about it. And then my mother said something like, yeah, and you know, he's watching on television. He's really into it. It's obviously a historic moment. And I really felt like, wow, I'm watching history. This is, so at that time I did start to appreciate the significance of it all. And then, you know, the years pass by and truth filters out and it becomes something totally different. Yeah, I think one of the reasons perhaps why it's not so defining in the way that you might think that it should have been is because so many of us now have come to learn that it wasn't everything that it seems, and it wasn't such a clear-cut case of good guys versus bad guys. You know, I don't want to get into 9/11 trutherism or conspiracies on this conversation, but there is a lot of that, and there is truth to a lot of it. I think we all know about dancing Israelis and all that sort of thing. Okay, well, what's that all about? And why did the Bush administration go to war in Iraq when Iraq didn't have anything to do with those attacks on that day? So what's that all about?
Yeah, and what are the odds of passports being found amongst the,
yep,
the wreckage? You know, the massive amount of, I mean, an ungodly amount of wreckage,
yeah,
carnage and whatever.
Well, you know, it's the jet fuel melts steel beams, but it doesn't melt these passports.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
You see, the thing, the way it seems to me is, and I don't want to talk about 9/11 at too much length because we've got our own topics to move on to, but the way it seems to me is that there's the conspiracy side weakening the whole thing. But I don't really think that's a big enough force to have the effect that we're talking about, where it just hasn't really taken hold as an element in our history. I think the reason that has failed to happen is that we simply aren't nationalistic enough anymore. Mm. If this had happened in the 80s or the 70s, it would have been huge, and people would have felt it deeply, and they would have been talking about it 5 years later, 10 years later. And instead, no. And I think there's a certain, even with the jingoistic, stereotypical American public talking about freedom fries and all that, even with them, I think they were jaded enough that they couldn't quite buy into it as much as they would have in previous decades. And that's why it just didn't take hold. It's an assault on a nation, but it was a nation that no longer meant that much to people,
yeah,
as it had in the past.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. I think there's something to that. America was already quite divided because of the Clinton years. The, you know, election controversies aren't really a new thing in America. The election of George Bush over Al Gore was very controversial. There was a lot of shady stuff going on with that election too. And so the country was already divided. And then I think also, you know, America wasn't perhaps, well, I guess America took quite a black eye that day. And because they haven't responded with unanimous victory like America did after Pearl Harbor and then joined the Second World War and helped win it, basically. So, you know, hoorah. America's kind of floundered since, and the response to 9/11, the response to that black eye wasn't really, I mean, even the death of bin Laden has all sorts of question marks around it, you know. So I think a lot of Americans lost their innocence and, like you said, got very jaded about it. And, you know, I haven't been in America for a long time, but I remember the years after 9/11, when I still lived in America. The 9/11 memorials every passing year seemed less and less publicized, broadcast, important, unifying. Very bizarre, but I definitely noticed that. I definitely felt that.
It's a strange thing. And to get move things forward to the Bataclan attack, you said that that had quite an effect on you because you're a grown man by then. And I'm interested in what effect did you see it happening, having on the people around you? Because obviously that's like, 2015, mm-hmm, as peak millennials being the young adults. They were in their early mid-20s at that time. That should have been a huge thing. Like the Charlie Hebdo attack, I think, earlier in that year.
Mm-hmm.
I think these events should have galvanized that generation against this kind of thing. And yet it really didn't happen. In fact, at the and obviously talking about generations is kind of redundant here, because at the end of that year, September, Merkel opened the floodgates to yet more mass immigration.
That's right, because this was already happening.
That could happen in the same year as these terror attacks. But sorry, go
ahead. The wave of... like I said, I had been kind of moving around, backpacking and doing all that kind of thing. And but I spent more time than I expected in France. And I had been to France on other occasions before then. And then, you know, when I was kind of observing what was going on, and of course, you know, I have friends in other European countries, and I'm seeing all these reports in the news of more and more migrants coming into Europe, immigration increasing into Europe, obviously being half Italian, something I've been aware of for a long time is, you know, creeping Islam in Italy, and you know, all these mosques keep getting built and all these boats keep arriving on the islands and, you know, things like that. That's been going on for a long time, years now, years and years. And then, you know, like you said, there was the Charlie Hebdo attack. There was the Madrid train station bombing. There was 7/7, you know, bombing in London. There's all these things going on. And then Bataclan happened. And prior to that, I was already, I think, if I remember correctly, I was already watching, you know, Paul Joseph Watson videos. I think I was already watching Sargon of Akkad videos and things like that. I think I might have already been watching you as well. I'm not quite sure, but I definitely know that after Bataclan, it was a very, you know, fast track. You know, the pipeline from, you know, conservative to alt-right, whatever it was called back then, I went through that pipeline quite rapidly. And as far as the reaction around people in my social circle at that time, I remember just... I think the very next day or 2 days after the attack in Paris. So I was living in Spain now at that time, and I had to go to a conference for work with my workmates. And we ended up going out for dinner. And this is like, I think it was the very night after the attack in Paris, in the Bataclan Theater. Also, I think there was the attack in the Stade de France during the Paris Germany football match, violence in the streets, etc. And I got into an argument for the first time, really, with someone about this in person. It was one of the first, you know, experiences with a shitlib, as we, you know, would later come to know these people as, because, you know, even at the beginning of the conference, before the, you know, the president of the company delivered the preamble to start the, you know, the conference, he actually, you know, said a word or two about Bataclan and, you know, said our thoughts and prayers are with the French, you know, that sort of thing. It was a very somber environment, very somber ambiance. And so it was also the topic of conversation as we went out for dinner, just myself and the few people that I worked with, because this was like a national conference, so everyone in my line of work had to go to this place. So there's, you know, hundreds of people, but it was just me and my fellow coworkers that went out to have dinner.
And what age were they?
Oh, they were on my age as well. They would be millennials themselves. But and we were also an international mix. So there was an Irishman who has remained a friend of mine to this day. There was an American. There was an Australian, I'm sorry, a New Zealander. New Zealander. And then there was this lad from Newcastle, and he's the one that I ended up having the argument with. Because as we're talking about, you know, holy shit, what happened last night was terrible. That's just unbelievable. And it, you know, you knew it was coming. You could tell it was coming. And my Irish friend, he was pretty sensible. He was pretty based. That word was not, I think, in my vocabulary at that time, but now I would, you know, call him pretty based. And then the guy from Newcastle piped up and said, yeah, well, I guess the French kind of deserved it, you know, for all their years of racism. And it's just like we have here in the UK, you know, now a bunch of racists are going to blather on about it and they're going to use it to justify Brexit or something like that. He said something along those lines. And I just said, you fucking prick. Like, the blood isn't even dried yet. And you're already talking about racism and Brexit and little Englanders. Fuck off. And we got into it. And eventually I just got up and left the dinner and I went out and walked through the streets of the city we were in. I just didn't want to have anything to do with that anymore, with those people or that particular person. I just couldn't believe it. And that was, I guess, my first real exposure to the kind of person that I've been railing against ever since as this Pax Populi persona.
See, I obviously have never met this guy. I can't picture him. I don't know what kind of social class he was from, what kind of background, but I wouldn't be surprised if he was what the Americans call a hick lib, where he comes from a fairly working class background and being liberal is his way of showing that he's worldly and educated and sophisticated. So he's got, I mean, not that there aren't middle class people in Newcastle, of course there are. It could be anything. It could be a champagne socialist, a middle class child of two idealistic, naive parents, and he's gathered the same ideas, and then he's got some international job in Europe, and he's living the high life. He feels very sophisticated, and then this thing happens, and he's just got to dismiss it. And so he'll talk about the little Englanders, the racists, the Brexiteers. Either way, whatever his background was.
He was kind of a hipster. He was a pot-smoking hipster. He was, yeah. What's funny is when we first met, to sort of break the ice, see, I was so naive at this time. I was so innocent. I thought everyone was, I thought edgy humor was something everyone was into. I thought everyone was kind of, you know, getting into Sargon of Akkad videos and watching Paul Joseph Watson and making fun of The Guardian. So when we met, when we first met or around that time, I remember I broke the ice by making a joke about Guardian readers. And he responded, well, I'm a Guardian reader. And I was like, oh shit.
Rather awkward.
Yeah.
Well, look, it is disgusting for a young man, especially, to react in that way to that event. Because a young man should feel testosterone, he should feel anger, he should feel rage at what is being done to his society, his country, and his ethnic, his people, his race.
Yeah.
And so for him instead to have this programmed response of, well, the racists are going to love this, well, they're going to make use of this. And
they deserve it. He said they deserve it, exactly. Yeah, that's what made me so angry, is that he said they deserved it.
You know, it's just pathetic. I mean, so you would... The way to deal with that is to, I would say to him, okay, so you're from Newcastle, England, history of racism there. Which of the people that you know in Newcastle deserve this? If it happened to them, maybe the guy who lives two doors down from your parents, does he deserve it? Does he deserve to get killed because of England's history of racism? No, he doesn't. You're a fucking piece of shit. And I don't know what else. I might be more articulate than that, but would he deserve any more articulacy than that?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just absolutely contemptible.
I've since come to a position where I don't even know if people like him have thoughts of their own. You know, like you said, it's such a programmed response. But there are so many of these kinds of people that have that programmed response. But yeah, what he said I lost all sense of my articulate speaking abilities as well in that moment. I had nothing more to say. I got very angry. I insulted him to his face, and then I got up and left. I mean, it wasn't a shining moment of, you know, of wit and verbal rapier skill. It was anger. It was anger and disgust, yeah. And then just leaving it there and walking away. I had my dinner on the table.
It's a shame about the dinner, but I mean, what else would be warranted in that situation? He needs to see that his attitude elicits disgust in people, and they just walk away from him. And so I think you probably did the right thing. I mean,
I told you that I have a pretty high bullshit receptor for, you know, certain things. And that's how, for example, I've always been pretty red-pilled on like feminism. But I also have a really high disgust reaction. Like I one of the reasons why I'm doing this is because I'm just disgusted by so much of what I see, and I can't not, you know, address it. I wrote in one of my Substacks earlier this year, I think I wrote it on the anniversary of the 1916 Dublin Easter Rising. And at the end of that, I wrote that I couldn't imagine myself not doing this, even if I'm having no effect, and even if we're going to lose in the long run. I still cannot imagine myself not doing this. I cannot imagine myself being silent. And one of the reasons why is that this disgust, this anger, I mean, a righteous anger, a justified anger, an anger that I've channeled into this, you know, what I'm doing. But yeah, in that moment, before I had, I suppose, even matured a bit more to the person I am now, it just came out. And it's like, you fucking prick. How could you possibly say that? A day, not even a full day afterwards? Like, the bodies are still in the theater. Unbelievable.
How did he react to that? Can you remember, or were you just sort of in a haze of anger at the time?
He had eyes like saucers, like, whoa, man, chill, bro. You know, I'm not having it. I'm not having it. He was, yeah, he was not expecting. I think he expected that the others sat at the table were going to nod in agreement. Yeah, that's a good point. You know, that is a good point. Mm-hmm. And well, one of them didn't. My Irish friend, later when we met back up, he loved it. He was cracking up. He just thought it was great.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, I'm glad that he's still friends with you now. That's good, because it's nice when a friendship survives different eras.
Mm. Yeah.
Usually they don't, actually, in my experience. Well, certainly when you're young, you go through friends quite quickly because you're changing and they're changing quite fast.
Oh, yeah. And I'm not even changing as a person. I've changed location so many times that it's actually very rare that I have, you know, close in-person friends, because they're just all over the place.
Yeah, yeah. Well, of course, that's another aspect of the age that we live in, that people move around so much. Mm. But you wanted to talk about, because there are obviously things that have happened this year, but you wanted to talk specifically about Substack and several essays, that actually an essay that I wrote and two essays that you wrote.
Yeah, I want to shill our Substacks, man.
Well, first of all, why don't you expound about how great Substack is? In your own opinion, what has it offered us? What has it brought to our movement and to you specifically, me, you know, all of us individually, that just wasn't there before?
Well, Substack is it's changed a lot, particularly for me, just as a contributor to dissident nationalism. I would say that this year has been my most productive year as a contributor to this thing of ours, and it's because of Substack. Now, when I first started, the reason I made YouTube videos, very bad YouTube videos where I'm just talking to a webcam. There's no editing. There's no intro music. There's no graphics. It's because I'm not good at that stuff. I've never liked that stuff. I'm not very technical. I don't like programming. I don't like computers. You know, I'm very boomerish in that way. And so I also did not know and do not know how to make my own website or vlog or blog or anything like that. But I've always been a writer. I used to, as a child, you know, sort of a precocious, perhaps wonder kid child. I didn't have a lot of friends. I didn't have a big social life. So I used to just sit in my room writing, and I would write all sorts of things. I wrote a 400-page medieval fantasy epic before I think I was even in my teens, just to amuse myself. You know, I never had any intention of that going anywhere or being published or anything. I loved Lord of the Rings. I loved the Redwall books. I loved the Chronicles of Narnia. So to amuse myself, I just wrote my own version. It was obviously very derivative. If I were to go back and read it, it doesn't exist anymore. It's on an old laptop that was like this thick, you know, it's from the 1995 or something. But I'm sure if I were able to read that, I would just be cringing at how derivative it is of all the things I was reading as a kid. And then when I went into high school, as it's called in America, and then I dabbled in university for a bit, I was always very good at writing essays. And then actually at one point, one of the odd jobs I did in my life was I had returned to the United States for a personal reason, and I had no money. So I needed to make money fast to move back to Europe. And one of the things I did to make money was I wrote essays for college students who didn't want to write their essays, and they would pay me to write them. I talked about this on one of my Telegram streams that I used to do. Basically, it was I found the job listed on this site called Craigslist. And it was Americans will know what this is, but for those who don't, Craigslist was this place where you could sell things, buy things. Jobs were listed there. And then it was basically like an internet hub of commerce and things like that. And the way it worked was I would get an email or a Skype message from like the kingpin of this illegal operation, really. and he would say that this person needed an essay, and then like we'd get the screenshots of like the curriculum. And a lot of the clients were Chinese university students in America, I guess just didn't have a good grasp of English or something. And so and it's just because it's so easy to regurgitate university speak. I was writing essays on Rousseau. I was writing essays on economics. I was writing essays on you name it. And you just have to regurgitate what you know the professor wants to see on the essay. And it's pretty easy. And so I'd be up all night just writing essays and sending them out. Okay, done. Send me another one. Done. And that's how I made some money. So anyway, the long and short of it,
you were getting paid by the Chi Coms.
Yeah, yeah, I was a Chi Com agent. Yeah, I it was very it was great. It was like, because I always wanted to be kind of a journalist before journalist became such a dirty word. You know, that explorer's mentality, wanting to see things with your own eyes, write about them, investigate, you know, that kind of thing. I definitely have that personality. And so,
yeah, I can imagine you like, at one point being a feature writer for National Geographic, where they pay you.
Yeah.
Like, I'm thinking of Diane Fossey, but obviously not that kind of, I wouldn't wish for that sort of end for you, but where they pay you, it must have been a fantastic job to have, you know, where they say, go to this place, find out as much as you can, and write about it.
Yeah,
and we're going to pay for everything.
Mm-hmm. Just yeah, that would be
fucking great for even for me, and I'm not a natural traveler, but even I would enjoy that that sort of leeway that they must have had. Ugh, fantastic.
And this just sort of happened. That doing this job also happened around the same time that I had really got into Tropic of Cancer, which people who've read that book will know what it's kind of about, you know, writers in 1920s Paris. I also really enjoyed Down and Out in London and Paris by George Orwell, which I have lived that book in many ways. I've also, done kitchen work in very much the same way that Orwell did in his younger years, trying to get by, scrounging any job that he can do whilst trying to be a writer. And so, yeah, I won't lie. There were times where I was, writing these essays at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I had a cup of coffee on one side of the table, a glass of whiskey on the other, and a cigarette dangling out of my mouth. And I'm just thinking, I am fucking George Orwell right now. I am doing it. I'm living the dream. I've fulfilled my dream of being a writer, but it was just to write essays for Chinese people. So anyway, that's something I've always enjoyed doing. And, I made the videos because I just didn't know what else to do, and everyone was making YouTube videos. But now that Substack is here, there's this really sleek, professional, serious platform that I don't have to create, I don't have to maintain, I don't have to pay for, I don't have to, code or anything like that. It's there. And it's pro free speech. Knock on wood. So Substack has given me the opportunity to write instead of doing YouTube videos, which I stopped doing a long time ago, really, and streams, which I never quite liked anyway. I wasn't much of a streamer. I can talk your head off, sure, but I don't consider myself a YouTuber or a streamer or something like that, And so even though I have done those things, and I enjoyed them, I enjoyed the Telegram streams that I was doing for a few months, but I just don't think that that's where my skills are put to their best use. Whereas with the Substack, the tagline there is Pox Populi, writer on Substack, contributor at Countercurrents. The reason I'm a contributor at Countercurrents is because Greg Johnson kind of stumbled across what I was doing and really liked my stuff. And so now many of the things I've written for Substack have also been published on Countercurrents. Because I've gotten a lot of positive feedback, people saying like, this is really good writing. And of course it's great to hear compliments, but just in a broader sense, I think it's great that more of us are writing. I think it's great that you have a Substack, and I always knew you're going to be a great writer. I think it's great because a lot of our videos don't exist anymore because they've all been taken down. A lot of our YouTube channels don't exist anymore because they've all been taken down. And yes, there are clips that go viral. There are segments of marathon live streams that go viral. But when you've done a 3-hour long live stream about something, it can be difficult to go back to that live stream and find the moment that you thought was really good or had some really good information, or it can be really difficult to share that 3-hour long live stream with other people and say, listen to this. It's really good. Imagine something on, the Second World War or meta politics or something like that. And even with a video essay, you can send someone a really well-made video essay. And our guys made really good video essays back in the day, really good stuff. But you never know if they're going to actually watch it, that person you've sent it to. Whereas with more of us writing, you can send someone an article or screenshot, a part of that article that you think is really pertinent, and just send it to a friend or send it to someone who you think needs to read this and know more or less that they probably will. They'll see that message. They'll see that screenshot. Or you send them, the full article, and you can trust that in their own time, they will probably read the whole thing and then go back to it. Maybe perhaps, I just don't know if people do that with really long live streams or old videos. I think they kind of have their moment in the sun and then they fade away. But when you've written something, it's, I don't know, I just feel like it's there more, you know? So I'm really happy with Substack, and I know you are as well. You've written some fantastic stuff, really unique stuff as well. I think it's very positive. And you've spoken about the importance of the look of the website. It feels professional, it feels serious, and that invites more serious people onto the platform. And there is so many good, there are so many good writers on Substack from our community, but also outside of it or adjacent to it. So yeah, I think it's a very good platform, and I'm very pleased that more of us are on it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll give my own perspective on this, but first I'll speak in defense of live streams to some extent. I mean, obviously you don't disapprove of live streams because you're here doing one right now.
Right.
But so I don't think that you're totally against it. Or
no, not at all. Not at all. Not
or something. But what I would say about live streams is it's primarily a social thing. And actually that's why Millennial is, you could say it's the, I don't want to, this sounds vain, I don't mean it that way, but I think that this is probably the best way to use the live streaming potential, because it is social, and that's the point of it. The conversations, I hope, will be good and memorable, and I think a lot of them are. But the primary thing that's going on here is people getting introduced to each other, getting to know each other, enjoying, you know, basking in each other's company during the coldest time of the year. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it's social. As for the intellectual substance, the weight of it, I think that's there as well. But as you say, it's there in a very disorganized form. There will be bits from a stream that you'll remember that it was like 1 hour, 15 minutes and 43 seconds into that stream. But you don't know what happened through the rest of that stream because you've forgotten it. But it was a moment that was very enjoyable, you identified with what the person was saying and so on. I think the rough and ready nature of live streaming is really that's the character of it. That's what people enjoy about it. And that's why it really doesn't matter if a live stream doesn't go quite to plan. Now, having said that, it is still a good idea to maintain discipline with a live stream, because there's nothing worse than one that has no discipline at all. And it's just, you know, we're sitting here shooting the shit, and 5 hours later we decide to, one of us either falls asleep or we decide to just call it a night now. And we've mumbled about 100 different topics or nothing for 5 hours. That is just a waste of people's time. So I do think that the live stream format is best done. It is rough and ready. It's going to be like that, but it's best done with some discipline. And that does take practice. And I remember my first live streams were just chaotic, just a disaster, because I had no idea of what to do. How do you do it? How do you maintain direction and focus? And I actually messed up even last night with the Semiogog stream, where I out of nowhere he brought a topic in at the very start that we hadn't talked about beforehand. And that was it. That was the stream sort of, I brought it back on. But anyway, whatever, it's Semiogog. People will still enjoy it. I don't terribly regret it. It's just something that happened. It's just a reminder to myself and everyone else that you've got to maintain focus with something like this, because otherwise it becomes boring, it becomes directionless, momentum is lost, and so forth. So that's live streaming. And I do think that, as I say, it, if nothing else, it's social and there can be intellectual weight to it. I think with Millennial there is. And also it forms a kind of social document, a record of things where people are speaking in their own voices, usually on screen. And so historically, I think it will be of value as well. So that's
I don't mean to.
I know you did.
In fact, I also appreciate the other side of this kind of thing, because if you think about it, the written word has only existed for a little brief moment in the grand scheme of human history. Most of the stories and the information that people exchanged was speaking. And in fact, even Plato warned that too much literacy would take away from man's ability to remember the spoken story and the poems and the wisdom and the history and everything. And I think that what we are doing is kind of, you know, we're speaking beside the digital fireplace and sharing stories and information and wisdom. And in fact, what I did with my Telegram streams in particular, we can talk about this later too. It might come up when we talk about one of my Substacks. But what I wanted to do, I've always wanted to do, is not talk about the events of the day or the headline grabbing events of the week or something like that. Or, you know, like I said earlier, let's look and see what the SJWs are up to and react to it. But it's kind of difficult to avoid falling into that. And so that was actually one of the reasons why this year was very productive for me on Substack. But actually, if you go to my Substack, you'll see that there's quite a lengthy gap, because I had left my Substack for several months. Because again, I just felt like I hate repeating myself. I feel like once I've said something, either in a video or a different essay, I don't want to go back to that. I don't want to repeat that. So I kind of just feel like, well, if I have said everything that I have to say on this subject, and I don't want to rant about, you know, things that we can't control, just that happens in the news and everyone else is talking about it anyway, so why bother myself? Well, then I just, you know, kind of keep quiet and don't really go back to it. So I left my Substack even for a while. So what I did with the Telegram streams was I would just tell stories and take questions and kind of just chat with the 12 or so people that were listening. And it was a nice little fellowship that we had there. But like you said, it takes a discipline. And I don't, you know, and when you're doing it by yourself too, when you don't have someone else on the stream, when you're just talking by yourself, it's very difficult to find, you know, material and keep it going and make it interesting and entertaining and all that. So I'm definitely not saying, you know, it's an easy thing or, you know, it's a lowbrow thing at all. It takes skill. But I just didn't want, I didn't want my streams to be, you know, okay, this thing happened in the news. Let's sort of whinge about it. You know, I want it to be a bit different.
It ends up being quite mind numbing. And there are other channels, that other content creators are doing that kind of thing. That ground is well and truly covered. I think it's more interesting to contemplate, what does it all mean? Where are we going? And and where were we before this? If we can be here now, then what about the past? Was it really as I was told? This kind of thing. Just to contemplate abstractions and the broader picture. I think that's more interesting. And now to get to Substack, my own opinion about it is largely what you were saying. It feels high quality, which matters, because it induces, it encourages you to care about it and the reader to care about it. That's crucially important. It also works well. But also, because someone mentioned, what about WordPress? Did you never think about WordPress? Here's the thing. I never thought about WordPress either. If you, a platform has its own appeal, and it will appeal to some people, and its rival will appeal to some other people. There's something about Substack which just makes you want to invest in it. You know, you could have a video blog before YouTube, but YouTube made a lot of people want to have a video blog because of it's a big platform. You know, a lot of people will find it, so it's worth your time. And also, you're carving out your own niche within that landscape. So it's different from having your own website where maybe no one will ever go. I don't know how often someone comes to millennialwoes.com. It's almost never. Social media is obviously a very different thing. It's much more shareable and people use it much more often. It's not like in, you know, 20 years ago where you would go to individual websites, people's homepages and whatever. So that's why social media, these platforms, it's why they're inviting. You can create your YouTube channel and it will be of the same format in terms of functionality as everyone else's YouTube channel, but it will have completely different content on it that is yours, that is made by you. And it's the same with Substack. As for writing, it's really just been a whole new lease of life for me. Thank you for what you said that about my work. This is, like, as with you, this has been, I think, the most busy year of my adulthood, of my life, really, and most productive, maybe except for the first year on with my channel, 2014. For a period, I was putting out one essay a week and one episode of The Gram every week. And that was, it was a fucking lot of work, but it was great. It was so rewarding. So, yeah, I'm very glad to be on Substack, and it's working very well. And I'm looking forward to going, returning to it after Millennial's over. Very much looking forward to it. The other thing to say about this is I agree with you that there is obviously value in live streams and in video essays, but there is something about the written word. There's a reason that we want, that we aspire, we wish we could get published. We wish we could have a book done out there physically, because that is, in a sense, to be accepted. It's to be part of the, your society's culture in a way that you're not when it's just a social media thing. There's a reason that we crave that. Now, we can't have that. I certainly can't have that. But we can have Substack. And as time passes, I think the old industries are probably going to be usurped by the digital equivalents anyway. So that brings us to Substack. So let's, having sung its praises.
Which I've also, I think the other day you said something about you felt nervous to praise Elon Musk for having liberated Twitter to the extent that he has, because you're afraid that the shit libs and the journos will use that as a reason to attack Elon's Twitter. And I feel the same thing. Like, I don't want to praise Substack too much, because then they will put Substack in the crosshairs and say, look at the people that are being platformed on Substack. But
yeah. And the ADL and the SPLC, probably hope not hate, will do that. They'll say, Millennial Woes recommends Substack. He's very happy. He's very glad that he's on Substack. It's improving.
They've already attacked Substack, particularly during the COVID years, because a lot of people, virologists, doctors, experts in their field were booted off Twitter and went to Substack. And of course, that put Substack in the crosshairs of those organizations that you've mentioned and the mainstream media. So it's, Substack has already been targeted. And I think I just saw recently that it's been targeted again. But there, at the outset, they made a pretty strong public statement confirming their belief in free speech and an open platform. So long may it continue.
Oh, absolutely. I'm honestly baffled. I just don't understand how Substack is able to do this. Presumably they're...
Because, as you said, they aren't like... And again, this is not knocking BitChute or Odyssey even, or Gab, or Truth Social, or whatever. What's the one? Parler, any of these?
Getter and all that.
Yeah. Getter, exactly. Because doctors and virologists and experts in their field migrated to Substack, there is a sort of quality control. I'm sure there are bad Substack writers, but for the most part, whether you're on the left, the center, the right, to the extent that those terms even have any meaning, whether you're just someone like me who's a college dropout, or whether you are an expert geneticist, virologist, whatever, everyone who's on Substack, for the most part, from what I've seen, is writing really good stuff. And so...
So it's difficult to condemn it as just a trashy website.
Exactly. Platform. It's not, you know, you're not getting... It was Endeavor, I think, who made this very funny post this year, I believe, which was like the typical BitChute comment section. And it was like, you know, Viking Pagan Warrior 1488, followed by a comment by, you know, Q is watching 002, followed by Christ is King, Griper 3.0, and all of the kind of comments that you would expect from those kind of usernames. Whereas on Substack, you're not really getting that. So I think that's one of the positives it has going for it.
Yeah. I just, as you say, long may it continue. I really hope. But the other thing I wanted to say about this is, and maybe you can chime in on this. Do you think that the age of the censorship online has now peaked? Because I get that feeling, partly because of Substack, partly because of Twitter. YouTube is a graveyard now for any sort of intellectual discourse. It feels to me like, and we've also, like, the world has changed so much over the last few years that COVID, I don't know, and especially now with Gaza, and the whole Ukraine thing has turned out to be a lot of bollocks. So I don't know. I don't want to nail my colours to this mast and, like, as a sort of rock-solid prediction. I just think the atmosphere is no longer ripe for censorship because people are no longer comfortable with the status quo, with the mainstream. I think most people now feel much less confident about their society than they did 5 years ago. So they're not going to back censorship in the way that they would have in 2017 and did. Now, what would you say?
Well, I think that the establishment, the regime, is very resilient, and you never know what tricks it has up its sleeve. I think the election of Trump, the rise of Lega in Italy, Vox in Spain, nationalism, populism all over Europe, that was like a white glove across the face of the liberal world order. And they responded in kind. They really did not like Brexit, Trump, populism, nationalism, any of it. And they absorbed that white glove across the face. They took that blow, and then they hit back really hard. 2020 election, online censorship. The leader of Lega, Salvini, was like put on trial for kidnapping and outcast from Italian politics. And so you never know. It seems like, yes, there has been a sort of black swan moment with Elon buying Twitter. I think it's funny that we all call him Elon as if we know him personally. We don't call him Musk. Why is that? Musk is also an interesting name to call him by, but everyone calls him Elon.
I know, it's kind of ridiculous. I certainly don't think of him as my friend, just to be clear to anyone. I'm not under any illusions that Elon thinks I'm fucking great. Just want to make that clear.
No, I just think it's funny that we all refer to him by his first name. Everyone does, even, you know, people in the mainstream media. So there's that. And yeah, perhaps censorship has reached its peak because I think, you know, again, the censoring of experts in their field during the COVID years really showed that, no, it's not about misinformation. It's not about hate speech. You just don't want anyone dissenting from the status quo and the official narrative. And we're going to talk about official narratives. And so I think that really did the establishment in. When you started censoring, you know, Robert Malone, when you kick him off Twitter, what is that? You know, what's going on there? So perhaps we have reached a peak. Also, another important point to make, we've been talking positively about this sort of mainstream platform, but there is much to be said for the work we've done in creating alternative media ecosystems. And Countercurrents, I think, has been around for a long time, but is part of that alternative media ecosystem. Gab, an alternative social media application. We have things like Imperium Press, an alternative to Amazon. I know Imperium Press sells some of their published works on Amazon, but they have their own company. They're their own thing. They don't depend on Amazon. So Amazon can't, you know, blacklist their stuff, their books, because you can still get them from Imperium Press itself. And there's more and more of that. And so we can also be proud of that and give ourselves a little pat on the back. I think it's, you know, that term anti-fragile, it's about becoming anti-fragile. So even if censorship has peaked or not, I still think we're in a good position because we've adapted to it. But yeah, I continue to be amazed. I guess it's kind of, you know, it's kind of a paradox. Why would I be amazed if it's happened so many times? But I expect it. But I do continue to be amazed at just how resilient the system of systems is. You know, it can absorb and withstand, and then almost use it like, you know, like judo, you know, how you use the momentum of your opponent to make them commit an error, and now you've got the upper hand in a counterattack because you've used the momentum of your opponent, the inertia of your opponent. That's kind of what the system does. You know, it takes the momentum of nationalist populism and herds us all into these ghettos where we're all being censored now, but, you know, and there's all these grifters that get promoted, and it's very complicated stuff.
Yeah, and also we start fight once we're in a ghetto or silo, we then start fighting against each other, like, you know, and the rats in a bucket. It's horrible. But I do, I take the point that they're able to use events to their own ends. And even like something happens that should show up the establishment, but then you realize that they've twisted it and they're now using it to strengthen their own position. Mm-hmm. It's incredible. But this is what you can do when you've got the media, when you've got the politicians, you know, that's it. That you've got the power, so you can twist events. It's really an amazing thing. Now, to get back to the matter of censorship, as I say, I might well be proven wrong about this. It's just a feeling that I have for the last sort of 6 months. I've thought, could they do, like, what happened in 2018, 19, and then throughout COVID? Could they do it again? I guess they could, but it just feels like the time has passed. It just feels like the public appetite to be kept in a censored environment to maintain the illusion of a functioning society. I think that appetite has gone because they've realized this really isn't a functioning society. There are things fundamentally wrong, whether they say that out loud or not, whether they even say it to themselves out loud, I doubt it. But I think it just does not feel like, well, 2015, 2010, or the bland. I often say that the 2000s, nothing happened throughout that decade. It was nondescript. But I think that the residual complacency of that decade is what enabled so much censorship in the late 2010s. And as I say, that complacency is completely gone now. So anyway, I mean, they can do whatever they like. I mean, if MasterCard decide to just issue an ultimatum to Substack, then yeah, something would have to change. And again, I don't want to give them ideas, but I mean, they've already have thought of that. They don't need me to. They don't need me to say it. So anyway, let's get to the essays that you wanted to discuss. And should we talk about my one first? Or yours? How would this make sense?
Two of the essays we're going to talk about that I wrote this year were literally years in the making. There were things that I've been thinking about for years. I've spoken about on the streams or in videos, Telegram posts, Twitter posts, but never sat down and wrote a proper essay about it. And one of them is about the Nuremberg narrative. Some people call it boomer truth. I usually call it the Steven Spielberg version of history. Now, boomer truth is fine, has a ring to it. Nuremberg narrative, very succinct and accurate. But I call it the Steven Spielberg version of history because his films in particular, Schindler's List, the way he portrays 1930s Germans in the Indiana Jones films, even Saving Private Ryan, he and others like him contributed to the idea that people have in their heads of these cartoonishly sadistic, evil for no reason 1930s Germans. And he also created this deep well of guilt in the hearts and minds of so many European peoples, not just Germans, but every white person, basically. This deep well of guilt, and then also this deep well of infinite goodwill to the Jews, for the Jews. And so I call it the Steven Spielberg version of history. So one of the things that inspired me to talk about this narrative, the Steven Spielberg version of history, the boomer truth. I mean, we've all noticed it. It's a pretty important part of our thing. And again, like I mentioned earlier, I made those videos trying to talk to conservatives, conservatards, you might say even. And one of the conservatard things that they love to believe is that the West itself is ruled by crypto Nazis. The EU is a continuation of Hitler's plans. It's the Fourth Reich. And they will use examples like, did you know that the heads of NASA were all ex-Nazis? And so that's proof that the United States is even ruled by Nazis who are just trying to divide us and, that sort of thing. And I hate that. I sent you, I don't know if you have this image. I used it in my, in one of the essays, the picture I sent you of a woman in a sort of provocative, it's a drawing of a woman in a provocative pose. And she's wearing a blue dress with it's the flag of the European Union, but as a dress. And she's sort of doing like the Marilyn Monroe over the street vent pose, but the wind blows up her blue dress. And on the inside of her blue dress is actually the red flag of Nazi Germany with the swastika, because the EU, according to the boomer, conservatard, is a Nazi institution. So this really annoys me, and I hate it. I hate boomer conservatives who, think that, or also, this was even going back to Orwell's time. Orwell wrote about this. Just everyone using the term fascist for anything they don't agree with. That's fascist. They're fascist. This is fascism. This is Nazism. These are Nazis. You're a Nazi. It's like, political discourse is now just two people accusing each other of being Nazis forever. And I find it really tiresome. And so that's when I say it's years in the making. It's like I've been observing this for years. And then two things happened. You wrote a brilliant essay on your Substack. I think you know how good it is because you have it pinned on your Telegram channel. but it was very, very good. I think you wrote two phenomenal essays. This one called Aryan Blues and your other one on Sinead O'Connor were just very, very good. But what you wrote...
Thank you very much.
Oh, yeah. I mean it. But Aryan Blues is about, it's sort of about deconstructing this Nuremberg narrative, the Steven Spielberg version of history, particularly the idea that the Allies fought the Axis in the name of combating racism or freeing the Jews or, bringing liberty. The 9/11 narrative, the invasion of Iraq narrative, we're going to liberate them. We're going to give them freedom and we're going to, be welcomed as liberators, as they famously said, Dick Cheney famously said. And you point out how, that's not actually true because American GIs had views on race relations that would have made a 1930s German blush perhaps. And Winston Churchill said things about non-European races that Hitler didn't even dare to say.
Yes.
And then even after the war, there was very little difference between British society, American society, British media, American media.
Yeah, yeah. Let's describe this first, because this is key.
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
An overwhelming majority, this is US GIs, soldiers in World War II, an overwhelming majority of them felt that black and white soldiers should be separated. during and after training. And as you can see, it's the huge percentage wanted to keep them separate, 82% in the training schools. I mean, that's incredible. And these are the men who fought the Nazis. So the idea that they were anti-racism is absolutely preposterous.
The original Antifa.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
That stupid canard.
Yeah. Even a centrist would say, yeah, but we were fighting against racism. We were fighting against fascism and white supremacy and all this. Well, these guys were white supremacists. They were they certainly wouldn't have liked the idea of racial equality in the United States, so that country would no longer be ruled by white people. That would have been a nightmare scenario for them. So, in effect, they were white supremacists. And certainly they were racists. I mean, there's absolutely no question about it. At least,
and I just want to jump in.
It's just important to nail this point before we proceed, because it's critical to. It shows how distorted this history has been.
I just want to say too, not putting words in your mouth, but and not to endanger your stream or anything. But for me personally, I don't think there was anything wrong with what they believed. I don't think they should be, you know, looked back in, bad light or be hated that their ancestors, that their descendants should look back on them in disgust. I don't think they had any wrong views. I'm totally fine with the views of these American GIs and British soldiers as well.
Yeah, we're not condemning them for not being progressives here.
Right, exactly. I just want to make sure that no one misunderstands what we're saying. That we're not. I'm not criticizing them for not wanting to have blacks in their platoon. And then in your essay, you also illustrate how even after the war, American society and British society looked very much like German society before the war. All of the adverts still featured beautiful blonde women and handsome white men. So basically, it's not until about 5 seconds ago that all white people, all European people, just suddenly realized that, oh my God, we're terrible. We are horrible people and we have to apologize for our racism and we have to reshape our entire society, our media, films, books, everything.
Just
fill it with Bamalians because we're so bad.
Because even as recently as
the 2000s, we weren't doing that.
Yeah. Even up to the 90s, everything was drastically white compared to today. Right, here's a collection of magazine covers from the 90s, and this was the norm. I remember it. Pox, you probably remember it as well. These are women's magazines.
I remember being able to read GQ and be inspired to be like the cool guys featured in GQ and, you know, wish that I had the money to buy the high-end fashion things advertised in GQ and read about cool men, white men in GQ. Now, if you read GQ, it is absolute cringe and ugly, diverse models.
Yeah, but we've got to make this point, though, because I want it to be very clear. Up until the 90s, up until the 2000s even, we still maintained what would now be called a white supremacist culture, where white people were front and center. They were the default. They were the model for all of society. And so this means several things. It means that the left are correct when they moan about our white supremacist societies. It also means that we maintained this culture from long ago, so we couldn't possibly have been opposed to the Nazis in this sense. And so that whole narrative about why we went to war is obviously not true. So, Pox,
I would say it's 90% not true, because when I was doing some research for the essay that I went on to write. So before we get into that, just again to sort of set the stage, Academic Agent has been talking about Boomer Truth for, I think, like 2 years now. Then you wrote Aryan Blues. I was also observing and getting very frustrated with sort of this Steven Spielberg version of history, everyone being equated to Nazis, Angela Merkel being called a Nazi when she was literally a member of a Leninist Marxist youth party. During the COVID, all these globalist liberals, and in some cases, ex-communists putting us under lockdown, were all being called Nazis and fascists. That's not what they are. And so I like to be accurate and honest with terms. I think it's really important to get the terms right, to get the language right. I agree with Semyagog. I think that a lot of the madness that we're living in is created via distortion of the lexicon. I caught that bit last night with in his interview. I totally agree. So getting terms right, defining them, and then using them correctly is very important. So finally, what really inspired me to make my contribution to the dismantling of this Nuremberg narrative was that something happened in Canada that I think really slipped under the radar of the dissident right. Because it happened in Canada, I guess, so nobody cared, but sorry, Canada. But it was actually really...
Before you get into this, it is worth saying that Canada is run by Justin Trudeau, clearly the Nazi problem is very serious there. Just wait until I show you this terrifying photo.
I think I know which one it's going to be.
This one.
This is what I'm talking about. I hate this. I hate it so much.
This is the point. For the boomers, the Nazis are the only reference point they have for evil and organized, mm-hmm. Tyrannical wickedness and so on. So they've always got to bring that into it somehow. Even if it's like this, this is absurd. The very idea that Justin Trudeau has anything in common with the Third Reich is ludicrous. So anyway, sorry to interrupt.
Oh, yeah,
so,
another example that came up in a different essay I wrote in the wake of something that happened on Twitter, which I don't want to say because we're on Twitter. By the way, isn't it great to be doing millennial on Twitter after so many years of your love-hate relationship with this platform? I think I sent you a message. It might have even been a public post. I said, imagine if Millennial Woes gets his Twitter account back after all those years of going on and on about it. It'll be greater than the Reconquista. And now here we are. We're doing Millennial on Twitter.
It's something else.
Yeah. Never give up, I guess. Or just hope some rich billionaire bails you out. I don't know what the lesson to be learned here is. But
well, exactly. I had completely detached from it. So I wasn't desperate to get it back. But then it happened. And it's a weird thing. But anyway.
So something that happened on that I wrote about in a different essay after something happened on Twitter. There's that guy Zuby. And he posted something that's just, it's absurd. It makes no sense. He said, and people loved it. Said, oh, Zuby nails it. Once again, spot on, Zuby. And he said something like, we are reliving the Weimar era. The ruling class today is behaving just like they did in the Weimar Republic. And they are copying right out of the Nazi playbook. What? Huh? What? What? Hold on. What? You cannot say that. I mean, that's so stupid. You cannot say that.
How could you miss the point so
exactly.
dramatically?
Exactly. We are reliving Weimar. The ruling class is behaving just like they did in Weimar, and they're copying the Nazi playbook. If you learned what Weimar was, then surely you must have learned that the 1930s German response to it, the NSDAP, was a resistance, a reaction against the Weimar degeneracy that you are now seeing play out again in at a global scale in the West today.
Weimar wokery.
But no, it's Nazi wokery woes. That's what they're trying. That's their mindset. So even when, so because conservatives are getting closer and closer, and even Tucker Carlson has made comparisons to Weimar, I applaud that. But we have to now guide them to the right conclusions, because if you are noticing the similarities between today and Weimar, but then still pinning the blame for both of these conditions, both today's conditions and the conditions of then, on the Nazis, you've missed the point.
You're a retard. Yeah, I'm sorry. It's yeah. Fucking retarded. How can you do that? I don't know. As you say, you've got to guide them towards making, because if you don't, they'll somehow mess it up.
And again, but just to clarify, why does it matter? Because every time the 1930s Germans get the blame pinned on them, we're essentially still pinning the blame on us, because the 1930s Germans now represent all of us, even the nations like the British who fought against the Nazis are now equated with them. And as I mentioned in this essay, it's called What to Do About World War II. The 1930s Germans are used as a cudgel to beat all of us, including nations that fought against the Nazis and including nations that didn't even participate that much in the war. So, for example, you look at what's been happening in Ireland over the year. Irishmen and women who protest in the streets demanding safety and a nation, you know, demanding the safety and security and prosperity of their nation, mothers pushing prams demanding safe communities, are called by the establishment, by the shitlibs, by the journos, by the political class. They're called far right, they're called fascists, and they're called Nazis. The Irish have no connection to even the far right, really. There is no far right in Ireland. Ireland's history has always been very Republican, revolutionary, not very right-wing. And this is an interesting point to make, is that you don't have to be on the far right to be a nationalist. There was a time when people who would be considered on the left were nationalists. But that's not quite here or there. But it's just the idea that you can call Irish mothers Nazis because they want an Ireland for the Irish and they want safe communities for their children. This is why it matters. We cannot move on from the Steven Spielberg version of history. We cannot move on from the Nuremberg narrative until we dismantle it. And it is being used against all of us. But what you, just to go back to what you said about how the narrative is 100% false, I would say it's 90% false, because when I was doing some research for part two of this essay, I can't believe that I never did it before, but I was curious to actually read what did Time magazine say about Hitler in 1938 when they named him Man of the Year, because this is another thing that the boomer conservatard or the Alex Jones fan love to cite, that Time magazine named Hitler Man of the Year. They use this in many different circumstances. They'll use it as an example of how the media are Nazis. So obviously a conservative or an Alex Jones viewer don't like the mainstream media. Fair enough. They shouldn't. And one of the reasons they'll cite for not liking the mainstream media is that the mainstream media are Nazis. And look, we know they're Nazis because they named Hitler Man of the Year in 1938. They'll also use this as another example of how the West is also secretly ruled by Nazis, because look, the establishment named Hitler Man of the Year. And they'll also use it as an example of how the media have always been able to brainwash us, and the sheeple have always gone along with whatever the media guides them into believing. For example, that Hitler is an admirable person and he's a worthy Man of the Year. But it turns out that Time magazine piece on him, naming him Man of the Year, was not complimentary at all. They insult him the whole time, and they demonize him already, even then. So one of the things that the writer, if you go on the Internet Archive, the writer of the article isn't listed. So it might have been like a committee of Time Magazine writers that put this piece together. But in any event, you know, they talk about how Hitler, sure, he's resurrected a moribund Germany and turned it into a force to be reckoned with, but he's also curtailing freedom. And there's been no artistic expression coming out of Germany ever since Hitler took power. And then also, very interestingly, just as today, the left likes to say that, you know, if the far right ever comes into power, we'll be living in a Handmaiden's Tale world of forced pregnancies or something like that. Well, in this 1938 Man of the Year write-up of Adolf Hitler, they say that. They say that in Hitler's Germany, women have been reduced to baby-making machines. So very similar things going on. So I would say, yes, the idea that, you know, the Allies went to go fight racism in Europe is 90-95% even bullshit. But they're at least... these writers at Time Magazine were in 1938 planting the seeds of this ideological narrative, this ideological justification of, in fact, I think, let me just see if I can get the words exactly right, what they say. They even say that, so the war hasn't even started yet, and they call it, they hint at a coming conflict between civilized liberty versus barbaric authoritarianism. So already in 1938, they're planting that seed that, you know, it's, we're fighting for freedom. We're going to liberate them, you know. But on the whole, yes, the narrative is quite wobbly. That, you know, that that's what the reason was.
Yeah, yeah. I'll have to track the article down and read it, because it sounds very interesting. Do they mention racism in it? I mean, obviously that term wasn't used, but.
I don't think that word specifically comes up. They insult Hitler as a brooding, unprepossessing man. And this was also interesting. They say that he sports a Charlie Chaplin mustache. So really, the Hitler mustache, it's actually Charlie Chaplin's mustache. Hitler was modeling his mustache off of Chaplin's. I just thought that was an interesting detail. If you go back in time, you know, it's not a Hitler mustache. He's not famous yet. It's a Chaplin mustache. Anyway.
I don't know who came first, actually. I can't remember now. I think Chaplin.
Well, I guess, I mean, reading between the lines, the context, it, at least in the opinion of those time writers, it's Hitler copying Charlie Chaplin.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't think they mentioned racism. There is an interesting moment. I'll just read directly what I wrote. The irony of all ironies comes when Times writer says, quote, "Fascism has discovered that freedom of press, speech, and assembly is a potential danger to its own security." And then I write, "For those of us living today, during the time when so-called free and democratic regimes are putting protesters in solitary confinement and using every tactic possible, including bald-faced authoritarianism, to suppress criticism and opposition, we can only read Time's piece with a very wry smile and shake our heads." Because they're doing the same shit.
Yeah.
And then I conclude by saying, it turns out that unfettered freedom of speech and assembly poses a danger, not just to supposedly evil dictatorships, but to any and every form of authority and government which has ever existed, including the sacrosanct liberal democracy. I don't think they mention racism specifically, but they kind of tick all the other buzzword boxes. But I apologize. I haven't actually explained why I wrote this in the first place. The thing that happened in Canada was that a Ukrainian Second World War veteran was invited to speak in the Canadian House of Commons And he was invited as a war hero because in today's context, Ukraine, which is supported by Canada, Ukrainians are the good guys. There's a war going on. Russia's the bad guys. And we want to boost morale and show, pay homage to this living Ukrainian legend, whose name is Yaroslav Hunka. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. So then what happened is this war veteran is invited to speak, or not even to speak, he's just invited, and then they gave him a standing ovation. And I guess invited isn't even the correct term. His grandson, I think, wrote to Anthony Rota, who was at the time, he since resigned because of all of the fallout from this. He was at the time the Speaker of the House of Commons. And his name is Martin, the grandson of Yaroslav. So he wrote asking if his grandfather could be invited to the House of Commons as a special guest on the day that Zelensky was going to be giving a speech or also being received in this Canadian House of Commons. And Anthony Rota, at the time, the speaker, agreed. He said, yeah, sure, that sounds like a great idea. And so then Rota gets up on the day of this occasion and says, we have here with us a very special guest. He's a Ukrainian war veteran. He's 98 years old. He too fought against the Russians in his time, and he's still today giving his support to the Ukrainian troops who are, again, you know, fighting against the Russians. And everyone stood up, all the politicians stood up and gave him not one, but two standing ovations. Well, then it turns out good old Yaroslav Hunka was a member of the Ukrainian SS. And this sent conservatard Twitter, Canadian conservatards, into just apoplectic conniptions, because the Canadian conservatard is already kind of fed up, I guess, with Ukraine. They don't like, you know, the sending all this money to Ukraine and that sort of thing. And they also think that Ukraine is ruled by Nazis and it's a Nazi state because, you know, Azov and all that kind of thing. So again, the same kind of stuff. You know, the EU is Nazi, the United States is Nazi, Ukraine is Nazi, Russia's also Nazi, apparently, too. You know, Russia's a Nazi fascist state, too. So we're all just Nazis and fascists forever. But now we've got, like, living proof, literally living proof that Ukraine is a Nazi state and the West is Nazi, too, and fascist, because they're paying homage to him. They're celebrating this SS officer. And so there was a lot of hullabaloo. That Speaker of the House had to resign in shame. Justin Trudeau had to make more than one public statement, an apology. We're very sorry. He curiously said, you know, that inviting Hunka was a mistake, and it dishonors the memory of all those who survived the Holocaust. No mention of dishonoring the memory of all the Canadian soldiers who died fighting Nazis. Just no. Only mentioning the Jews who died in the Holocaust, because everyone else just gets ignored, apparently.
Well, of course. And the same now with the Palestinians in Europe. You know, what they've said about white people doesn't matter. It's what they've said about Jews that suddenly it matters a huge amount.
Yeah, same thing. But then what was really interesting was seeing even some Canadian liberals, because the Canadian liberal has been told to support Ukraine. And whatever you think about the war in Ukraine, whatever side you've taken, even though you're not actually in the war at all, so why are you, no one's forcing to take sides, but everyone seems to have taken their side. Regardless of that, the fact is that the sort of Biden voting, Trudeau voting liberal in the West supports Ukraine. They all put Ukrainian flags in their Twitter bios, right? We know this. Now, what the regime was able to do is quite astonishing, because the same people who worry about a backlash against Muslims every time some jihadi blows up kids in a concert arena in Britain are now like bloodthirsty. They just want to slake their thirst for Russian blood. They've been given the okay from the status quo to become kind of like war hawks, just only with respect to Russia, and call, you can call Russians orcs, you can demonize them. And again, whatever side you're on, I'm not making a judgment on that. I'm just saying this is the reality that's happening. Western liberals were sort of given a green light to warmonger and to demonize an enemy and to show ardent support for the side that has been deemed the good guy. But what was fascinating about this and what this caused was this moment of, I guess, a nuanced perspective in their minds, because they've been conditioned or encouraged to support Ukraine. But now, here's this Ukrainian SS member. But wait a second, he is a war hero. He did fight the Russians. He did fight for Ukraine. And the Russians are invading Ukraine again, and Ukrainians are having to fight them again. So wait a second now. Who are the goodies? Who are the baddies? Oh no, I know I have to have thoughts of my own about this. And there were Canadian liberals, leftoids, you know, on Twitter saying, look, the guy defended his homeland. Because Jarosław Hunka was threatened with extradition by the Polish government. He went from, you know, living out his last days in obscurity to then being feted in the Canadian House of Commons to then being threatened with extradition all within a matter of like 3 days. And he's 98. And then people are saying, but he was an SS member and the SS committed atrocities. Well, not his SS unit. In fact, his SS unit was investigated on more than one occasion for committing war crimes, whatever. And on each occasion, on each investigation, found not guilty. So this particular unit of the SS did not commit atrocities or war crimes. And then responding to that, were Canadian liberals saying, well, even if his SS unit did commit war crimes, who are we to judge? Because again, they have to defend Ukraine. They have to defend this Ukrainian hero. They've been, again, sort of conditioned to take this position. And so they were saying, many of Canadian liberals were saying, were we any different? Our pilots took part in the firebombing of Dresden. We incinerated mothers, children, women, old ladies. We took part in that. Are we any better? So I just thought this was a very significant moment, because for the first time that I can think of, we have Western liberals, Western progressives taking an adult position on the World War II narrative. And that's all I'm asking. In order to dismantle the Nuremberg narrative, all it takes is an adult, nuanced perspective. You don't have to be a Natsok. You don't have to throw up Romans. You don't have to even believe in National Socialism or fascism as a correct political system. Just having an adult perspective on this conflict and dismantling some of the lies and the exaggerations and the atrocity propaganda, the Steven Spielberg version of history,
just
is
having
a huge step in the right direction.
Yeah, just having a grown-up enough attitude towards it that you're not relying on absolute caricatures of good and evil, the good guys and the bad guys, because that is just infantile. In any war situation, it's going to be very complicated. World War II is the, and everyone says that about World War One, that we've got no idea really how it started. Even we don't know when, what was achieved by it. No one knows, and good people on both sides. You can say that about World War One, but World War Two, it's the only one where it's completely black and white. That one side was wholly evil, irredeemably evil, to such an extent that even though Germany is no longer the Third Reich, it's no longer Nazi, we've got to be very careful about the Germans. You know, they're still touched by this. It's still in their DNA, maybe.
Well, it's got to the point that, like we said, that if Angela Merkel sends us into a lockdown, that's Nazism.
Yeah, and the other side was wholly good. But yeah, and Angela Merkel, exactly, she let in, 2 million for non-whites into her country, and then still, that's still not enough to wash her of the potential sin of being a Nazi. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous and childish. And as grown adults, we really shouldn't need to think in these ways, to such simplistic. I mean, it's degrading. It's degrading for all of us that we have to, that there's any pressure, that there is this pressure to have such an absurdly simplistic worldview. But that's what is demanded when it comes to World War II.
And that's what I thought was so significant about this this event, and in particular, the aftermath of it, because it wasn't just Canadian liberals on Twitter having this nuanced perspective, being forced to have this nuanced perspective. Even Politico, what's the name of the journalist who wrote? Keir Giles. So he wrote in Politico an article responding to this, you know, fracas, the headline of which was, "Fighting against the USSR didn't necessarily make you a Nazi," with the subtitle, "Canada's Junca scandal is a demonstration of how, when history is complicated, it can be a gift to propagandists who exploit the appeal of simplicity." And credit to him, in his article, he even takes to task Jewish organizations who made a big stink about this and, you know, got all offended and tried to do the usual canceling and shaming because Junca was invited to the House of Commons. And he even calls them out and says, you know, basically that was wrong and uncalled for because this guy didn't do anything to Jews. His unit was cleared of ever committing any war crimes. And he was basically just a Ukrainian fighting against an invader. Who wouldn't do that? Of course, now this makes us have to ask all sorts of questions. Why was the USSR invading what we call today Ukraine? What's going on there? Why did men like Junca enlist in the SS to fight them, to stop them? What's going on there? It's not so simple now, is it? And because the Canadian liberals in particular, has been encouraged and been sort of guided, pushed into such a pro-Ukraine stance, it was just really interesting watching them all have to take a nuanced position and analyze the complexities of this war, because how else could you still take this Ukrainian war veteran's side unless you do this, unless you start being an adult about this and look away from the Schindler's List version of history?
Yeah, definitely. And as you said, Saving Private Ryan as well. There was a fantastic, back in the days when Morgoth had a blog, he did an essay, a short article based on a video that I can't remember who it was who did it. It might have been Rob Eggers. Can't remember. But anyway, it was about how propagandistic Saving Private Ryan actually is. And it was astonishing. It was a list of distortions or things that Spielberg had done so as to ensure that that the audience felt a certain way about the Germans and a certain way about the Americans. And it was really amazing to see, okay, this is how little he thinks of his audience. This is how little he thinks of truth and nuance. This is how cartoonish he wants your worldview to be. He's even prepared to, like, for example, cut the Germans' hair short so that they like shave their heads so that they look like skinheads. That sort of thing. Even removing a subplot about a German soldier who had a hold on a minute removing a subplot about a German soldier who had a photo of his daughter. And I think that that was taken out of the script because that would humanize this German soldier. So it's all about, it's pure propaganda. It's all about making the Germans, not even the Nazis, because a lot of these soldiers would not have been committed Nazis, making them look as awful as he possibly can.
Yeah, there's a scene in Saving Private Ryan where some German POWs are being marched through an American encampment, and the Jewish member of Tom Hanks's platoon mocks them by pulling out his Star of David necklace, and he says to each passing German POW, "Juden, Juden," like, "I'm a Jew, haha." And then, of course, he gets killed in like the most painful way. It's like he gets stabbed slowly by his big hulking German villain, and you have to watch it as the knife goes into him very slowly. I'm sure everyone who's seen the film remembers. And then also Steven Spielberg was involved in the creation of Band of Brothers. And there's also some of that going on in the latter episodes of that series where they, the Band of Brothers, liberate a death camp and discover that all the inmates are Jews. Oh my God, what horror, you know? People, so I used to be very into cinema. I was quite the cinephile. And in my college years, I dabbled in visual arts and filmmaking and that sort of thing. And one of the courses I took on cinema, on film, you know, was about the great directors and things like that. And part of the syllabus was about the auteurs. And really, in my opinion, there are very few genuine auteurs. And we had to argue about this and have debates in class about who are the genuine auteurs of cinema. And Steven Spielberg was listed in the names of filmmakers who you had to argue if they were genuinely an auteur or not. And the reason being is that, well, you know, he meets one of the criteria, which is that he has a, you can tell a Steven Spielberg film because he does certain things all the time in all of his films. And one of them is he has, all of his films have something to do with father figures and their absence or their importance. So for example, in Jurassic Park, the character played by, I forget the actor's name, but Dr. Grant is the name of the character.
Jeff Goldblum.
No,
Sam Neill. Australian. Sam Neill, right, yeah.
Yeah, Sam Neill. So he becomes like a father figure for those two kids, right, who don't have a father figure. I suppose Tom Hanks becomes like the father figure for his platoon in Saving Private Ryan. And again, it's about saving a young man, and he becomes like this father figure who saves Private Ryan, right? Obviously, the father and son relationship in Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade. But another thing that Steven Spielberg does, perhaps not as frequently, perhaps not in every single film like he does the father figure motif, but it's the cartoonish, sadistic Nazi villain motif. Not even Nazi, just German, the German villain. It's in so many of his films and other things that he has worked on as a producer or executive producer. And so, yeah, to see people having, I mean, it was very interesting to see this all play out. And the only reason I suppose I saw so much of it was because the Twitter algorithm, once you start liking things or responding to things or retweeting things, it just fills your Twitter feed with that thing too. So I think I had liked and shared something by the, what's he called? It's getting a bit late, so my brain perhaps isn't working. The Ferryman's Toll, who's a Canadian content creator. I hate using that term. But he's a pretty cool guy, and he has a really, really good Twitter account and a very good Telegram account as well. And he is not a Canadian liberal. He is the opposite of that. But he was also taking to task people who were trying to demonize or cancel or, you know, extradite this 98-year-old Second World War veteran by doing the same thing, you know, mentioning all of the war crimes that Canadian soldiers participated in, and also, again, dismantling that Nuremberg narrative. So I had liked and shared some of what he was doing, and then that just meant that my Twitter feed got full of Canadians reacting to this thing that happened in their House of Commons. So I got to see a lot of it playing out. And the best one was this guy, I think his name was Michael Gibbs on Twitter. And he has like the rainbow flag in his bio and everything. And he went from posting about how, you know, I'm gay. I think he even said he was HIV positive. So he says, I'm gay. I'm HIV positive. And I know full well that if I were alive in the time of the Nazis, they would have rounded me up and put me in the camps. So when I see Nazis, I will call out Nazis. I know a Nazi when I see one, et cetera, et cetera. So he went from posting things like that to, in the wake of this Hunka debacle, posting things like, who are we to judge this SS member? It's just, that's a very interesting shift. And I think this event was, I want more of it. I want more adult, nuanced discussion around this war for the reason I said earlier. We cannot have nations for ourselves. We cannot have any in-group preference. We cannot take our own side. Even if you're the Irish, who had very little to do with the Second World War, or even if you are British and actually your ancestors fought against the Nazis, we still can't have our own nations. We can't have secure borders. We can't have in-group preference. We can't protest in the streets for safe communities, safe neighborhoods, without being called Nazis. Because of this Steven Spielberg idea that anything associated with nationalism is akin to Ralph Fiennes walking around a death camp shooting Jews in the back of the head.
Yeah, well, obviously I couldn't agree more. I think this is largely tied to that, to generations, if you're going to use that term. Once a certain generation die off, this narrative is going to dissipate. That might not be the end of the matter. I mean, it's possible that, well, it won't be the end of the matter because there are other narratives that are taking over from it, like white privilege and so on. Mm-hmm. But definitely the Holocaust stuff is already, it's just nowhere near, it doesn't have the hold that it had 10 years ago or 30 years ago when we were kids, you know. It was, I mean, everyone was obsessed with it. The adults, everyone had seen Schindler's List, all of that. And also the older than boomers as well, were also very, equally, they had quite an unnuanced view of it all, because they had lived through the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. So that is a thing. I think, as I say, it's on the way out. There are other dangers. I mean, that does not mean that white people are safe. There are other narratives that are going to threaten us. But nonetheless, I think this is an interesting and noteworthy development. So Aryan Blues, the essay, was really, it was to try to wake people up, to make them realize if that is the version of history that we've been told and it cannot possibly be true, then what is the truth? And if our conception of ourselves now is shaped by that version of history and that version of history isn't true, then our conception of ourselves is also, has been mangled. It's mm-hmm. distorted. So,
and what was very good in that essay, and why I, when I shared it, I said something like, this is a very good essay. It should be shared widely. Even if you've already heard it before, share it because there's things that other people might not have heard and need to hear. And first and foremost among that is the World War II narrative has put, in particular, in specific to your essay, the British right on the back foot for 70 years. Because the British right has to say, first, well, it's the British right has to believe a lie. Usually it's the Antifa left and the transgenderist libtards, you know, that are, we say their whole worldview is based on lies. They're always pushing lies. But in this case, it's actually the conservative British right that has to build their worldview on a lie. And when the left comes at them with the truth, well, then the British right ends up looking ridiculous, and it's very easy to attack them and take the legs out from under them because they are on very weak footing. And so what your essay did very well was kind of nudge unit. it nudges the normie British conservative, who I hope does read it, it nudges him to just take his own side. Okay, yeah, the British were pretty much on the same page as the 1930s Germans, as far as race relations, nationalism, values. But you know what? That's fine. Okay, we didn't fight the Germans to save the world from tyranny and give the world freedom and stop racism. We fought for probably myriad reasons, many of them materialist, shallow, opportunistic. But that's fine. I'll look into it more. And that doesn't mean that my grandfather who flew a Spitfire is a dupe or fought on the wrong side. You know, okay, you can have that discussion later. But it just means, okay, I want a Britain that is safe, that is British. I want the Britain that I grew up in for my children. And I can't have that because every time I say that I want that, I'm called a Nazi. What's this about? And I think your essay does a very good job of nudging British conservatives into taking their own side.
Well, thank you. I certainly hope that it does. Not many people have been able to argue against it, interestingly. There was only one person in the comments under it, and I kind of felt that she'd missed the point. And no one else that I can remember. And I don't even say that as a boast. I'm kind of surprised. I thought there'll be people surely arguing against this, and I'll have some work to do in handling their arguments, but no.
Well, maybe that's a sign that you're right, that maybe it is, you know, it is on its way out. This narrative is coming apart, because I'm not so sure. I'm not so optimistic, actually. I see it everywhere. I write about this too. I see it. I mentioned Ireland as an example. Other countries, you know, I spoke with Guido Tajetti earlier this year on a Countercurrents live stream. And he's an Italian fascist. And you can be, to an extent, an Italian fascist. There is a thing called the Mancino Law, which prohibits fascism in Italy. But yeah. But, you know, fascism in Italy, it's a very different thing in the Italian world. Yeah.
Let's not get into that. That's a whole diversion.
Well, what I want to say is that even countries that were not a part of the West up until 1945, like Italy, now do the same thing where, you know, an Italian who was against COVID lockdowns for 3 months will say that the left-wing government, the center-left, which is actually quite extreme left, I think, government, liberal government that's putting him in that lockdown are Nazis, are, you know, not, so everyone's doing it.
Oh yeah, yeah. Because that's the reference point. It's like the Canadian boomers who say that Trudeau's a Nazi. I'm not saying that,
but I'm not sure if they're all boomers. That's the thing. Indeed.
I'm not saying that it's gone. I'm just saying I'm surprised that not many people argued against my essay. Maybe it wasn't widely shared enough. That's not a hint. I'm just saying maybe that's the reason that it didn't get much pushback. I don't know why else. It could also be that it was just a head fuck for people to read, which I would hope it was. I'd hope it was, because a lot of people need that regarding this issue. Hmm. All right, we'll get to some super chats now, and then we'll wrap up, because I am meant to be doing the Christmas card stream just now. Obviously, there's no time limit, particularly. Thank God there's no other stream coming up, so I can relax. Okay, MI5 Surveillance Van says, just to let you know, literally nobody reads The Guardian nowadays. And yes, I use the word literally due to my paucity of vocabulary. Well, thank you, Mr. Surveillance Van. Well, yeah, I suppose The Guardian isn't. I mean, The Guardian has been kept going for a long time. It is known as the in-house newspaper at the BBC. It's very possible that without that support, it would have gone under many, many years ago. It's one of these cases where they keep it going because it's so useful. It's a cultural force. It might not be financially self-sufficient, but that doesn't matter. They'll keep it going anyway because it's a cultural force. Hardly anyone reads it nowadays. Well, you know, I wish that were true, but there clearly are people who still, it's their Bible. It's the thing that they live by. So anyway, I wish you were correct. I hope it is soon the case that no one is reading The Guardian. Magic Man said, every real man is disgusted by what is going on. This is, he talked about the Bataclan. This is why they aim to feminize all of our men. Yes, I agree. Der Fliegenfanger, thank you for your work. Thank you very much. Neil Before Jimmy says, I would like to thank Pox Populi for writing my essays and thereby helping me get my current job as head of MI5. Merry Christmas and good Yule. Very good.
Very good.
All right. Salmon of Knowledge says, Happy Christmas, lads. Loving the conversations. Thank you. Surveillance MI5 Surveillance Fan says, David Cameron implored us to hug a hoodie. Well, I say hug a boomer. Thank you. And, okay, someone, I'm not going to read that name out, says, Merry Yule and hail our folk. Thanks, Woes and Pox, for this great European tradition. Thank you very much. And then there are some super chats here from Black Pigeon Pilled. Can Pox elaborate on his optimism for unrepresented nations, such as the Cornish, the Welsh and the Manx, making decisions locally without interference from Westminster? I ask, as an obscure Austrian painter rubbished the idea of an independent Bavaria, and Franco famously pursued a policy of one Spain. I do, however, concede unionism seems done for in Britain. That's leaving aside those outside Europe, the Assyrians, Kurds, Tibetans, etc., who will probably never receive their own state, no matter which superpower dangles it forth as a carrot in front of them. So, okay, can you elaborate on your optimism for unrepresented nations such as Cornwall, Wales, and the Isle of Man, making decisions locally without interference from Westminster?
Well, I don't know if I would say that I have optimism for it. It's just what I believe. It's just what I want. I spoke about this a lot in 2022. In fact, it was going to be our millennial topic, but we just talked about other things instead. Because I had made that a theme of many live streams and Telegram posts, and the idea that I just believe in ethno-nationalism. I think that is the antidote to globalism, and I don't like globalism for reasons such as I just don't believe that it is a moral system or even a functioning system, that law can come from Brussels and dictate how the Irish are supposed to behave. And that is the case. In fact, an Irish MEP said that he prefers to continue working in the European Union because basically all of Irish law is made in the European Union and then just transposed onto Ireland. Well, I don't like that. I don't think that's right. And so this is kind of even why I went from being a Sargon of Akkad enjoyer to a Millennial Woes enjoyer, is because when you take ideas to their logical conclusions, you have to make some decisions about where you stand on things. And so if I don't like globalism, well, then what am I for? Okay, well, I'm not for a white imperium or a white superstate. I'm on the ethno-nationalist side. And Well, what does that mean? Well, it means that I believe that nations, peoples, should have sovereignty and should be able to organize and order a political entity, let's call it the nation state, according to their customs, traditions, and desires. And important things go into this, like language differences, but also genetic differences, historical differences, historical events. And when this problem plays out in the real world, we get some very tiresome and I would say almost like tropes now, like again, the sort of boomer truth. So for example, in Spain, the Catalans want to be independent of Spain. They want Catalonia to be an independent nation state. I think that's fair enough as an ethno-nationalist. And I say that knowing full well that most of the Catalan independence movement is full of like Antifa, libtards, progressives, and the moment they get independence, just like Scotland would do, they're going to run straight into the arms of the EU and they're going to throw open their borders to infinitesimalians. But what happens in this discussion is that you get the the Catalan separatists call the Spanish nationalists who want to maintain a unified Spain, well, they call them Francoists, and they call them fachas, which is like fascist, and they call them Nazis as well. Well, then in return, the Spanish nationalists who want to maintain a unified Spain, well, they call the Catalan separatists Nazis and xenophobes and supremacists also. So again, the whole discussion is retarded. But I don't have any problem with, in theory, an independent Catalonia. I think, you know, provinces, regions in Italy should be independent. And in fact, one of the reasons why is because of my love for Italian dialects, which in some cases might as well be classified as completely different languages. The differences are that strong. But they're all dying out because of unification. And the unification of Italy hinged upon making Tuscan Italian the unifying language of this new nation state. But if you had, you know, an independent Umbria, if you had an independent Emilia, well, then they could have, you know, they could have media broadcasts, they could have television broadcasts, the daily news done in their dialect. And that would be great. And they could maintain a very important part of what it means to be Emiliano, what it means to be Romano. You know, they could maintain that. In the case of the British Isles, it's the same thing. And you've spoken about this, that you think the United Kingdom pretty much served its purposes when the United Kingdom had an empire, and now being unified, having, you know, Scotland, England, Wales, all that unified together, you're not so sure if that has a purpose anymore. And again, knowing full well that if Scotland were to gain independence, they would just run right into the arms of the EU and be an open borders progressive libtard state, I get that. But in theory, I support Scottish independence. And in theory, I support Welsh independence. And I support Cornish independence too. And in fact, I've got a little bit of Cornish in my Celtic side. And we maintained that Cornish tradition by making Cornish pasties a lot when I was a kid. So yeah, I believe in something that radical liberation termed medieval anarchy or something like that. Because he has the same thing. He wants to go back to that map of Europe where it's just like loads and loads and loads of tiny little heraldic shields, because every little province had their own little state, basically. I think that's the antidote to globalism. It's autarky, it's locality. And one of the main reasons why I believe that, though, is because all the things that I care about in life, I think, are better preserved, cherished, understood, and given a chance to thrive in those conditions. Whereas all the things that I care about in life are threatened by globalism and some homogenizing gray goop, you know, of authority that just kind of mashes everything together.
Yeah, absolutely. And it does so knowingly and deliberately and apparently joyfully, which is grotesque. There were two other super chats. Black Pigeon Pulled asks about the certain trope. Yes, I think that will get stale. It depends. It's answered in what we were saying earlier. And then you also ask about, I don't want to go back into the Ukraine thing. I hope you understand. I'm tired. I think Pox is tired as well. So I don't want to reopen that whole topic now. But thank you anyway for the super chat. And I also think it's probably answered by what we were saying earlier. All right. Well, let's call it a night there. This has been quite a long one.
Did you want to talk a bit about the art, or shall we leave that for another time?
Let's leave that for another time. I'm getting tired, so I want to get along because I do have one more stream to do after this.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
Yes. All right. Well, this has been good. So thank you very much, Pox. I think that's all of the messages that we should reply to. Yes, I've linked your essays several times in the live chat, so hopefully people will find them. All right, and I'll add them to the video description as well. Okay, right. So Pox, thank you very much for appearing on Millennial 2023.
Loved it. Thanks for having me on.
Excellent. Okay, see you all in a little while. Maybe 3 or 3:15, like on the hour or 50 minutes after. I need to have a break, have something to eat, and then get the camera set up for the Christmas cards. So that's been a little while, but not too long at all. Bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. T-shirts and mugs and other wondrous gifts are available at the merchandise store. Impress your family, friends, colleagues, and business partners with these incredible items. All aboard. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word. Oh.